Do we need to review a Victorian novel?
Which one would that be?
I don't know. Just one of them that has her and her consort. I mean, do we want to get Prince Albert in the can?
Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Sutai Vampir and Jajim Vestai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And today we are going to talk about The Klingon Gambit by Robert E. Vardaman. Published in 1981.
Here, guys, this is not a Klingon game.
No, not at all.
Okay, this is a story that was written prior to Star Trek Next Gen. So the Klingons are going to be wholly based on the original series. I mean, we've had Star Trek the Motion Picture by this point, but the Klingons in this book are straight out of the original series Star Trek.
All right. So go ahead and give us a brief summary of the plot, and we'll move right into this.
From the back of the book. Here we go again. Back of the book. Get to the back of the book, people. When Captain Kirk and his crew are ordered to Elnath 2 to challenge the deadliest Klingon starship, Terror, they're ready for anything, or so they think. But the defenseless Vulcan crew of a Federation science ship has been wiped out. The remaining members of the Elnath 2 mission have discovered a fabulous ancient city, but their report makes no sense. The Klingon battlecruiser has the Enterprise in its sights and is ready to destroy it. But Captain Kirk can't seem to make decisions. Spock has to throw temper tantrums, and Chekov has disobeyed vital orders. The crew of the Enterprise is losing their minds one by one, all victims of the Klingon Gambit.
Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah. Okay. I kind of made a joke at the beginning about the Klingon Gambit being a series of moves in a chess game like Klingon, but
right.
Jim, just your opinion on this. Why was this book called The Klingon Gambit?
I really had trouble figuring that one out myself.
I couldn't.
I guess maybe because they thought they were going to find treasure, and you have the captain, who seems to be constantly under the threat of a mutiny, and his first officer almost accomplishes it. So I don't know.
Yeah, you pick up the book, you look at the cover, and you're going, wow, the Klingons have a plot in motion to do something. And they're reacting to the situations just as much as the crew of the Enterprise is.
Right. Yeah. It was, I'm not sure why the title, but I guess it had to be called something.
Yeah, well, you never know. Maybe it had to look, what am I looking for? Ominous. That the Klingons were up to no good. And boy, I don't know. It just, you go through the whole book reading it going, where's the Gambit? I mean, at least they could have some guy throwing playing cards at people.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a wrong Gambit, though. Wrong universe.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we'll just have to X that one out.
Aha, uh-huh, yes, of course. All right.
Going through the book, though.
Yeah.
Haven't I seen this somewhere before? the whole plot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you've taken the Naked Time and This Side of Paradise, and you added another one, I think.
Yes.
All Our Yesterdays.
Mm-hmm.
Throw them together, put them in a blender, and came up with something. Probably the, well, come to think of it, I can't think of the name of the episode now. It's the one with the androids. You could even throw that one into the blender, too. Because it turns out...
That would have been iMud.
No, not iMud. They find the ancient machine that makes androids.
Oh, yes.
And the reason I bring that one up is because the plot does center around something that the Andorian archaeologist finds in his dig and, you know, kind of pushes aside because he's looking for something else.
Yeah.
To me, this novel reads like an episode from the original series. But, you know, it is the third book in the line of new stories based on the original series.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty sure the author was instructed to write it as closely to the original series episodes as he could. And as you pointed out, too, it's right after the James Blish novel. So that formula worked.
Yeah.
Let's not throw it out.
And by the way, the episode you were referring to, what are little girls made of?
Yeah.
Is the one you were thinking of.
Yeah. But it is. They find the archaeologist there finds a machine that can produce androids and literally put people's minds into them.
Yeah.
We find a jewel on this planet, and the jewel is putting off a radiation or something to cloud men's minds.
Yeah, we never really find out exactly what it is doing other than, well, we'll get to that in a little bit. Go ahead, continue.
Because only the shadow knows.
Yes. Continue on with your opening thoughts.
Kang, Koloth, Kor, Kallen, Cleese. Until we get to Worf, why do all Klingon names begin with K?
Yeah.
There's no K in the Klingon alphabet.
Well, maybe in Klingonese there is, but not Klingon whole.
Yeah, I know. That's one of the jokes that Lauren Shone always makes when he's teaching Klingon is, there's no K in Klingon.
But, you know, that seemed to be something that original series did do a lot. All the Klingons had names beginning with K. All the Vulcan male names began with S, and all the female Vulcan names were a T apostrophe something.
It's kind of a joke from the old comic book era, where all characters in the comic books had to have a double letter.
Right. And I don't...
Lois, Peter Parker, Reed Richards.
Mm-hmm. And I don't recall if we got any Romulan names during the original series to know if they had another
way of doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I don't think we did either.
So
even the Romulan female commander in the Enterprise incident was the commander.
Yeah. Yep. So there was Tal. He was her first officer. That I do recall. So yeah, who knows? Anyway, my overall impressions, I completely agree how this reads like an episode of original series, and as you said, it's understandable since James Blish's novelizations of the original series, the last one published in 77, were very, very popular. I read them all.
And that was only 4 years before this one came out.
Right, and I read all of those and over and over and over again. I think I got used copies and wore those out.
Well, at the time, they were the only things you had.
Yeah. And it does seem to parallel Naked Time and This Side of Paradise. And I thought, you know, we could also throw in All Our Yesterdays, considering Spock's emotionalism and his attraction to Heather.
And when I read that in your comments, I'm sitting to myself going, wait a minute. Did the writers of Trek go out of their way to find ways to make Spock emotional in as many episodes as they could?
or did they go out of their way to give him challenges to not be emotional?
Okay, it's just he does break down quite a bit.
Oh yeah. Well, he's half human. For the most part, I really enjoyed this book. I was a little disappointed with the cause of all the problems for the people on the ships and the Andorians. I was looking for something maybe bigger, more sinister, or at least a sentient presence of some sort that was manipulating things. But
you're looking for something that they couldn't just go into orbit and nuke it from orbit, and that way they knew it, they took care of it.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I just, there were some things, but what do you do? It's a one-off novel. It is non-canon, and I enjoyed it overall.
Yeah.
So we move in. We have all the usual characters on
with a couple more added
on the Enterprise, and we add a couple, and everybody is acting weird. Okay, Spock is emotional. McCoy, all through the book, all he wanted to do was blow the Klingons out of space.
I think you're thinking Chekhov.
No, well, McCoy too.
McCoy wanted to go back and be an old country doctor.
Yeah, but he did, but
he wanted to blow his machines out the airlock.
Right, but he also commented quite often about how the Klingons should be, just eliminate them.
Scotty became obsessed with his engines.
Yeah, he had them up to 104, 106 % efficiency.
Yeah, and you realize if you studied efficiency at all, and the way you define efficiency, you can't be greater than 100%.
Mm-hmm.
It just can't be done.
No. Well, as we know in physics, basic physics that we learned in high school, you cannot get 100% out of a machine. You're going to lose something in the operation of the machine no matter what. So,
well, just the basic definition of efficiency is, I think, the heat produced and the heat lost. So the best you can do is bring that down to zero. If you have zero heat exhausted, you are 100% efficient.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
So you have to have negative heat lost to be more than that, and can't be done.
That doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't.
So,
but what gets me is you got the Mary Sues beginning here. You see it in a lot of the Star Trek fan fiction, the Mary Sue character, which is a female that comes into the Enterprise. She's all-knowing, can solve any problem, and it's the love interest of everybody.
Yeah. Yep. And that was McConnell, that, right?
Well, and Lieutenant Alvarez.
Okay.
Now I'm drawing a blank. One of them was the archaeologist, and the other was the engineer. McConnell must be the engineer because she was Scottish. That's what drew Scotty to her.
Ah.
But, you know.
Yeah. Well, we have a couple of Klingons, only two named Klingons. Kalan, who is the Dreadnoughts, or the Terror is what the name of the ship was. He's the commander, and Kislath, who was his first officer.
You know, this might have been more of an interesting book if the author had been able to get into the Terror and talk about what was going on in there, in the circles of the Klingon world.
Yeah, it just kind of glossed over, didn't it?
Yeah, everything was from Kirk's perspective.
Right. Every meeting that Kirk and Kalan had prior to the one on the planet was on the Enterprise.
Yeah. But, I mean, the whole book tends to be from Kirk's perspective, which, you were talking about in notes earlier or later, that Kirk seems to be one of the least affected persons.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not really, because if it's from Kirk's perspective, the more Kirk is affected, the less he realizes he's affected and doesn't notice so much the changes in him.
Ah.
So, yeah, he notices Spock's aberrant behavior, you know, notices McCoy's, puts Chekhov up on charges, but he's not going to notice his own behavior because he's going to assume he's normal.
Yeah.
We see it in some of the things he does and some of the things he questions. But, you know, it's just he thinks he's okay.
Yeah. So we have a few places. Well, we have the Andorian. I should mention him. Threvelon Da. Threvelon Da.
Who one is, of those names that you read in your mind, do not try to pronounce, and just say Andorian every time it comes up.
Yeah, or that guy.
Yeah, or that guy.
An archaeologist who is absolutely obsessed with finding something that he does or doesn't know whether it's actually there or not. He suspects it, but in his mind, it's there, and he does not care about anything that has gone on. He doesn't care about the T'Pau being wiped out, the crew. The ship
other
is,
than getting his tools.
Yeah, he needs his tools. But the ship, the entire crew of the T'Pau is gone. The ship is completely intact and floating in space. He doesn't care what's going on with the Enterprise. All he does through the whole book is harangue Kirk to get his equipment or a replacement for the equipment down to the planet so he can do what he's there to do.
Now, that brings up an interesting question. They find T'Pau. They go to the T'Pau. They see what's happened to it and its crew, and they leave it there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wouldn't you have towed it back to a parking orbit around the planet that you're going to investigate until you've got time to tow it to someplace where it can be taken care of?
Yeah.
Back to some star base.
Well, wouldn't it be a navigational hazard just leaving it hang there?
Well, nah, I don't know so much about that. Space is really, really big.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, if they call for help, most likely.
Yeah, I see it. It always gets me. I'm always seeing these stories about somebody's blockading the planet, and we can't get around them because they're blockading the planet. And the reality is, the normal situation is, they got a few ships on one side of the planet around the equator. Wait a minute. Can't you just go over to the other side and come down? Or if they've got ships over there, so say they've got a ring around the planet. Can't you go to the north or south pole and come in from that direction?
Eh, you probably could. I don't know. It depends on the sensors, I guess.
It's amazing how easy it is to blockade something that is so frickin' big.
Well, yeah. Well, and then I suppose, you know, and we're going off on a tangent here, but I suppose if the ships that are doing the blockade are stationed over major population areas or something like that.
If they're defending an area. Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah.
If your goal is to either A, get onto the planet, or B, get off the planet, come on.
Yeah.
It's a big planet. There's lots of avenues to get off or get on.
Right. Now, you mentioned that the planet where they were, that was not Alnath 2, or was it?
Yeah, must have been.
Okay, it's the only thing I could come up with because, you know, the planet was referred to as the planet most of the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't...
It would have been referred to that at the very beginning, and then they just dropped it.
Yeah. So you have a few things here that you wanted to discuss.
Okay. Like I said, it reminds me of this side of paradise with the spores from this side of paradise being replaced by some form of radiation.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, we had that on this side of paradise also, but...
Well...
Oh, well.
Yeah. And it must be some kind of psionic radiation. Not a harmful not something that would be normally considered harmful radiation, like gamma rays or something, but more of a psionic radiation that was affecting everybody.
Yeah. But then again, remember, we're talking Star Trek now, so we can have radiation that is not on the EM spectrum. It was Bertholdt radiation, I think, in This Side of Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
So we can have some form of radiation that gets in and kind of disrupts the workings of the brain.
Yeah.
So it doesn't necessarily need to be psionic, but it can interfere with the neurons firing inside your skull.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be what was happening.
Yep. And is this the first time we've seen the Klingon advancement in rank through assassination?
Yeah, it may very well be.
We saw it in Mirror Mirror, but that was Federation on Federation.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right. So.
And well, that could be where Robert got the idea for it, so.
No, it isn't the first time we've seen this. Because did we not have in one of Keith's books an officer?
Okay,
I think
Keith's books came out later.
Oh, okay. All right.
This book came out in 1981.
Now, who actually killed who? Because we didn't really get a change of command on the Terror.
I don't know that anybody killed anybody, but Kislath, was attempting to kill Kalen. Because Kalen, you know, for reasons that we're going to see in other Klingon stories are legitimate Klingon reasons for being not protecting the ship, not doing what he needed to do as a Klingon officer.
Yeah, that's the way he perceived it through his delusions, his disabilities, yeah.
And if you break it down to its barest essentials, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Klingons win.
Okay, explain that.
What are the Klingons after?
They're after a substance that will help them...
help their life support systems. They're based on it.
Right.
Okay, what do the Andorians want?
They were looking for archaeological discoveries.
They were looking for a city.
Right.
Did it exist?
Well, it did and it didn't.
It only was in his mind.
Well, it was actually there, though, because the crystal made it happen.
In his mind. I don't know. And did the Enterprise come out of this with something, or did they just survive?
Basically, yeah. They just basically survived. But, you know, it was...
The one that got the prize that they wanted was the Klingons.
Yeah. Now, I don't remember the substance that they needed... that the Klingons needed. Do you recall what it was called?
Not offhand. It started with a T, I think.
Yeah, I don't remember. But at any rate, it was very early in the book that the Klingons needed this and the Federation did not.
The Federation had several planets in its control that could mine this particular material.
Yeah, and the Klingons had very few.
And they were poorly supplying it. This planet had a rich deposits of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and as far as Kirk was concerned, you could have it all. Take it all.
Yeah.
You know.
So, the Klingons win.
Yeah. Well, everybody wins, right? Except for the poor Vulcans on...
The Vulcans got what they wanted.
Yeah, even they win. So, a few things that I came up with. I thought... That there was a point in the story where Chekhov felt that the Klingons were getting ready to attack the Enterprise. Chekhov was in command of the ship at the time, and he decided to do a preemptive strike, which didn't come off, thank goodness. But, I thought it was kind of extreme the way Chekhov was hauled in front of a board of inquiry because of what he had done. And, you know, for him, this could have been a career-ending move on Kirk's part, where, you know, Kirk could have ruined Chekhov forever. I was happy that it resulted in an acquittal, but the other problem I had with this part was how the story seemed to come to a dead stop to have this trial for several pages, and there were way more irons in the fire that were far more serious than that.
Let's take it back a step. Why the heck is Kirk getting an ensign command of the ship? Okay, Scotty's not there. I understand that. He's down in engineering and trying to goose the engine some more. But you've got Uhura, who outranks everybody else, and then you've got Sulu, who outranks Chekhov on the bridge.
Yeah.
Two potentials. Now, I can understand that this is the time period in American history where we really can't have a woman in charge of the ship. That's going to come later in Trek.
Mm-hmm.
So that rules out Uhura. But still, Sulu's had command of the ship during a Klingon crisis in the past. Why wasn't he given command?
Yeah, that's true.
Now, I can understand you want to temper Chekhov so he will grow into being that commander. But do you temper somebody immediately by throwing them in the deep end of the pool?
In this situation, I would not. Were I in Kirk's place, I definitely would not put an ensign, especially one who is showing signs of being a hothead, in command during the situation where you have a giant Klingon ship hanging off the bow and you have Klingon citizens on the planet, Federation citizens on the planet trying to do a job, and after coming across a Vulcan ship, everybody's dead on board the ship, and we don't know why. Because it was, you know, my first thought was, oh, the Klingons killed all the Vulcans.
And you know Chekhov's a hothead because Kirk has already had two different incidences where he's told him, Chekhov, get your finger off the button.
That was several times. So, yeah, I wouldn't have put Chekhov in charge. Maybe Kirk should have went up in front of a board.
Well, and then again, why would you have the board on board the ship?
Well, and then again, during a crisis.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, if you're going to do that, you're going to throw Chekhov in the brig and let him cool his heels there. And then when everything's resolved, then you're going to have...
I would think you'd go back to a star base, and then you would have...
Yeah. Well, I suppose, you know... Well, who knows what the author had in mind.
Yeah, because, you know, to me, I would think if you're going to have a board of inquiry, you want to do it with officers that don't know Chekhov.
Yeah. But my point is we stopped the story at this point and went another direction, and it was distracting. So
it was court martial, another episode of the original series all over again.
Yeah. I was also a little disappointed the way Kirk was handling everything. He didn't seem to be quite as affected as the others on the crew, which is not surprising because he always seems to be the level-headed one no matter what's happening around him. But he was indecisive for the most part, even whiny at times. You know, Bones, bad things are happening on board and I don't know what to do about it. You know, Kirk's Klingon counterpart also seemed to be unaffected because he remained in command and he was investigating the situation. You know, are all captains in Star Trek immune to things that affect their officers?
Like I said before, in Kirk's case, you're looking at it from Kirk's point of view. So in Kirk's point of view, he's not affected.
Mm-hmm.
All you see to show you that he's affected is like his comment with Bones.
Yeah.
You know, about things. You see examples of him being affected, but not as strongly as the others because he's judging the others and not judging himself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Klingon commander, all we see of him is his interactions with Kirk. So those interactions are going to be, okay, call Kirk up on the, communication thingamabobby. Call him up on that. And then he stiffens his spine up to deal with Kirk. You know.
Yeah.
That's what you're looking at.
Mm.
you see Kislath's reactions through Kalen, and you see that he's being more affected, we think, than his commander, because his commander is seeing what's happening to him and relaying that to us through Kirk.
Mm-hmm. So, another thing, well, I've got two more, and both of them refer to the ship T'Pau. It got a little bit irritating how the T'Pau kept getting dragged into the story, and the final explanation to me kind of smacked of Deus Ex Machina when it was revealed that they had evolved to a higher plane of existence because that's what they desired and that's what the crystal on the planet granted them.
Which is interesting because I kind of thought that the crystal on the planet was doing a mind control trip on everybody, so...
Right, so, you know, here we...
Like the Vulcans should still be there.
Yeah. So it also kind of, if since we have been mentioning episodes that it kind of put us in mind of, this one kind of reminded me of Shore Leave, where all you had to do was think about something, and you get it, and you should be happy, but some of the things you're thinking about are quite deadly.
Yeah. I mean, McCoy did get skewered by the knight in shining armor.
Yeah, and there was the tiger, and there was the Japanese strafing run, and Don Juan.
Yeah, but it just, if it was mind-tripping, which allows everything to be the same, the only way you can explain the Vulcans not being there is if they had figured out that they could evolve to a higher plane by beaming into space.
Mm-hmm.
But that's me coming up with an explanation for what the author should have told us.
Finally, you know, the Vulcans, the ship was named the T'Pau. Now, as we know, T'Pau was a Vulcan matron who was presiding over Spock's wedding at a muck time. Do the Vulcans actually name their ships after living people?
Don't we?
I don't think we do. Do we?
The USS George Bush was named that while the ex-president was still alive.
Okay. All right.
But, you know, it's a good question because it's hinting at part of the culture by looking at their naming practices.
Mm.
It's like, looking at why do all Klingons names begin with K and Vulcans males begin with S and, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah. Well, you know why? The bottom line is it's in the script.
Yeah, it's only the bottom line if it's the last line on the page. If you're going to start the page out with this on the top of the page, the ship is called the T'Pau. No, that's the top the page, okay? That's a top line.
Yeah. All right, so we have a concept to discuss. What happens when we lose control of ourselves?
Oh, wait. We've explored that in several episodes of the original series already.
Oh, yeah. It's a constant theme that appears throughout all of Star Trek.
And literally was taken, the Naked Time episode was literally taken into Next Gen as one of its earliest episodes. It was kind of a remake of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this one was an outside influence. Now, people do tend to lose control of themselves from time to time, and make poor decisions. It happens. So, you know, I guess it's just something that is fun for an author or a screenwriter to explore. You take this character that you've established and turn him upside down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, and, you know, every author is probably going to explain it or look at it in their own way, which explains why we have multiple lose control of yourself plots going on.
Yeah. So, we got, how about favorite points of plot?
How about unfavorite points of plot?
Okay, I'll let you elaborate on that.
Spock gets a girlfriend again.
Yeah. And he doesn't like it.
She and Nurse Chapel fight over him.
Yeah. He don't like it, though. You know, he recognizes that he's giving into emotionalism and he doesn't want to go there.
He doesn't like it when she's not around. And as soon as she's around, he's falling into it again.
Yeah. And that thing between Nurse Chapel and that character, that was hilarious.
And then they're good bosom buddies at the end of the novel.
Mm-hmm. Both of them talking about Spock behind his back, of course.
Of course. Gotta throw those cliches in. No way of getting around it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm tired of this. We need to accept the fact that Spock is unemotional. We need to use the character as he is set up in pieces that can make sense from that. If we look at the motion pictures, they have eliminated that side of Spock. And is Spock any less Spock in the motion pictures?
No.
In fact, it's safe to say that Spock is more Spock in the motion pictures. He uses his unemotionalities and non-humanness in Star Trek 4, The Voyage Home, to point out flaws in 1980s culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even in Star Trek 6, there's a couple of things that happen. Spock tells someone that, hey, look, logic is not the end of wisdom. It's the beginning of wisdom. So
yeah.
It seems that he would have come to a certain point where he realizes that he has to embrace the side of himself that he's been trying all his life to purge and figure out how to make it an advantage instead of a disadvantage.
Well, the problem there is that all through his career in the Federation, he has seen this emotional ship's captain pull their fat out of the fire.
Mm-hmm.
So there's got to be something there that is non-logical that makes the resolution of the crisis favorable to them.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I had in mind was, and I think it was Star Trek VI, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but where Spock says to Kirk, has it gotten to the point where you and I have become so old that time has passed us by?
God, I don't know which movie that was in. I'm thinking it was probably Star Trek 2, because isn't that the one where you had Kirk's birthday?
Yes.
And they were all ruminating on, I'm getting too old for this.
Yeah, you might be right. Might be. Yeah, you're probably right.
I could be wrong, too. So if you listeners out there think I'm wrong, write your comments to us so we know you're listening to us.
Yeah.
Because we really want you to be listening to us.
That's why we're doing this, okay?
Favorite plot points, I guess, if you go back to that, it's the exploration of an ancient city. You know, it would have been good if A, it was real, and B, they delved into it more.
Mm.
We've been on the Enterprise. We've seen the Enterprise. We've seen the inside of Klingon ships. We haven't seen this city.
Mm-hmm.
Show us this city.
Well, we saw glimpses of it and things like that, but it was all what Trevelyan Da,
the Andorian, thought.
What he was envisioning would be there.
Yeah.
The crystal made that for him because that's what he expected. That's what he wanted. Otherwise, it didn't exist at all.
But even if they had just shown us the city that he thought he wanted to find, that would have been a insight into the Andorian way of thinking.
Yeah, true.
Okay, and that leads to the question, who put the jewel in the stabilization cradle that it was found in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What race of people either made or found this device that was causing all these problems and put it in the cradle?
Yeah, we get nothing on that.
And it just occurs to me, we haven't talked about this crystal yet, this jewel yet.
Mm-hmm.
The whole plot of this novel revolves around this particular jewel that's sending out something, some sort of radiation or something that is affecting everybody who comes to this planet. Okay, if that's the case, and this cradle will stop it from doing that, which is what's implied with them putting it into the stabilization cradle, and everything goes fine, why does this alien race abandon this crystal in this stabilization cradle instead of nuking the planet from orbit?
Right.
A scorched earth policy on this planet will keep this jewel from doing its thing and messing everybody up.
Yeah, and the Klingons could go in and mine the substance and be done with it.
And we could have a real Klingon gambit.
Correct. You know, I didn't really have a favorite point of plot for this book. They're just...
It was tough.
Yeah. It flowed along like an episode would. There were some things that were good. There were some things that weren't so good. But, you know, I still enjoyed the story, and it read just like one of, like an episode. It was very short, quick, and entertaining.
It's a 158-page novel.
Yeah.
And while we're saying that's short, that's only because today we're used to novels that can barely hold together when they're bound. But back in the 80s, 70s and 80s, a 150 to 160-page novel was the norm.
Okay.
Books like Dune were incredibly rare. If you look at the follow-up to Dune, Dune Messiah, it's back down to about 160, 170 pages.
Yeah, it's much, much shorter. So let's talk about the themes. Diplomacy instead of confrontation.
Check off, get your finger off the button.
Yeah. Kislath, get off the bridge. We had these...
Kislath, you see that airlock over there? Go inspect the inside of it.
Yeah. Now, we had Kirk and even the Klingon commander, Kalan, who were doing their best to avoid a fight because there was no fight necessary.
Yeah.
And on the Klingon side, I guess Kalan was dealing with one mutiny attempt after another because he was... When he didn't blow up the Enterprise, he was perceived that he...
As un-Klingon.
That he wasn't doing his job. Now, is it Klingon... Is it the Klingon way to fight whether you need to or not? Or if it's not necessary, do you avoid it, especially when your mission is to gather that substance for the life support system?
Well, remember, a lot of the precepts from the Klingon Art of War involve fighting.
Right.
You know, involve testing your honor through conflict. But, again, that's going to be the later Klingons in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, but what the...
Right now in the Star Trek universe, it's, you know...
What the Klingon...
The mission.
What the Klingons wanted, they didn't have to fight for. It was theirs. Just go ahead and take it. You know, that's fine. Just stay away from the Andorians. That's all we ask.
I don't know if it was theirs to take, because the Federation did get there first.
Well, the Federation doesn't need it. The Klingons do.
No, they don't.
And
but I think according to the Organian Treaty, the first one to get there has the right to try and improve the planet on their own before the other side gets a chance to improve the planet.
Yeah.
It just turns out that the Federation doesn't want the mineral rights to the planet. They just want the archaeological rights.
Correct.
So a deal is strikeable under the Organian Treaty.
And it seemed like that was going along just fine, except that we had this insanity taking place amongst the subordinates.
Well, with everybody.
Yeah.
Because the Andorian, who we think is doing okay, but is actually dreaming about the city, we see again through Kirk's perspective and don't necessarily notice that he's dreaming this stuff until the very end of the book.
Yeah. So you also have here, don't go into situations with expectations. They may be self-fulfilling prophecies.
Like you know,
they didn't have
it. The jewel's going to do it for you.
Yeah. and of course, that was, it set up a lot of really bad situations.
Yeah.
Everything, you know, we had a delusional Andorian archaeologist. We had an over-aggressive ensign. We had a wimpy Kirk, and we had an emotional Spock and McCoy who wouldn't rely on his equipment to do his job.
And Kithless, who wants command of the Terror and sees his chance to get it.
Yeah, but that fails, thank goodness. Otherwise, it would have been a whole different book.
I don't know. The thing is, you're still under the Organian Treaty. If, what would happen? I mean, we've never tested the treaty in any of the episodes or any of the books. We've talked about it in the books, that it's there. But nobody has gone to press the button to start the fight that the Organians would have to stop.
Yeah, absolutely. We get all through these books that we've read, we get the Organians popping up over and over and over again, and they really never have to interfere for whatever reason.
Nope.
So
yeah, don't go into situations with expectations that Jewel may be there.
If the Organians did get involved and the Klingons start a fight and the Organians kill the Klingons, then we have just absolutely broken one of the cardinal rules of these books, which is make sure everything is the same at the end as it was at the beginning.
Which is the cardinal rule of the TV series, too.
Yes. You make drastic changes and you have a real problem.
And we've already touched on the next one. The engines are fine, Scotty. You hit the point of diminishing returns. Give it up.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, if you really want to stay with McConnell, take her to dinner. Be done with it.
There you go. And then I came up with one, recognizing when one has a problem and how to deal with it.
Yeah. Well, how to deal with it can be a tough question. But if you can recognize that you've got a problem, you typically know who to go ask to help you dealing with it.
Yeah, recognizing you have a problem, you at least have a first step towards getting better. So how about closing thoughts?
Well, I think I said earlier, I would have liked to have seen things more from the Klingon point of view. In the episodes we've already talked about, everything is seen from the human point of view. In this book, we're pretty much seeing it from the human point of view. But events went on the Terror. Events that would have shown the effect of the jewel, just like the events on the Enterprise. So it would have been nice to see what was going on the Terror, to get more of an idea of the Klingon culture of this time period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my closing thoughts, and I kind of answer yours a little bit. I would personally, I'm going to rate this book to be 3 mind-altering jewels out of 5. I didn't hate it. I didn't love it, but it was entertaining and well-written. I also agree with you that the Klingon point of view would have been a lot of fun to explore. But at this time, before Next Generation, Klingons were just stock characters in original series, and they were just designed to be bad guys of the week.
They were the Soviets.
Well, yeah, they never, none of the baddies really got developed very much. And so they're just the bad guys of the week who show up.
Yeah, they were the bad guys in the original series that showed up more than one week.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're looking at, you know, a new alien race is threatening the Enterprise, and you never see it again.
Right. Well, we had 7 episodes that featured Klingon foes that ranged from very, very bad, not very good villains to some very, very good villains. So, anyway.
And those very, very good ones ended up showing up again, literally, in Star Trek DS9.
Yes, the 3 best ones. Well, I guess that about wraps it up for today. Next month, we will be looking at Star Trek Ishmael by Barbara Hambly. Apparently, Spock is going to spend some time aboard a Klingon ship, so we may get a different point of view in this one.
And Barbara knows how to write aliens.
So, there we go. So, where do you find us? Well, if you're listening, you already know where to find us, but have you told anybody about it? Have you passed the word around? Get out there and get the word out about Bound by Honor. This is a great podcast for us to... I really enjoy it myself, and I would really like to see word get out and get more listeners and all that good stuff. So shout it from the rooftops. Drop flyers out of your Klingon vessel.
More importantly, get your white shirts. Get your standard one-color ties. Put them on. Knock on your neighbor's door. Ask them, have you heard the word of Kalis? Or at least listen to the CAG podcast?
Well, that would be another way to do it. So, join us next month, and we hope you enjoyed this episode. For Bound by Honor, I am Jajim.
I am Jordan.
And join us next time for the Klingon Book Review Podcast. Kapla! You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keech. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!